This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Like many parents across the country, over the weekend I received an email from my daughter's school. It told us that in the wake of the deadly shooting rampage in Newtown, Connecticut, the school's priority was to help our kids feel safe. It said that if students felt the need to talk about the horrific events of last Friday, counseling teams would be in place to answer their questions. And it urged us as parents to talk to our kids about what happened, to assure them that while this tragic event is hard for all of us to understand, this kind of thing happens extremely rarely, and that everything possible is being done to keep them safe.
But beyond that sort of broad outline, how should we, as parents, talk about the slaughter of innocent children and their teachers with our own kids? How do we walk that fine line between acknowledging their fears about such a ruthless act of evil while also assuring them that they are safe? What should we say to our very young kids and to our teenagers? And what should we be careful not to say? And how do we, as parents, prepare ourselves for these conversations?
Listeners, you can join this conversation. What are you telling your children about Newtown? What are they asking you? What advice are you looking for? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And joining me now is Wendy Price. She's a psychologist at a public high school on the South Shore and former president of the Massachusetts School Psychologists Association. And Wendy Price, welcome to Radio Boston. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
And here in the studio with us is Deborah Rivlin. She's director of education and training at the Children's Room, a nonprofit dedicated to supporting grieving families. Deborah Rivlin, welcome to you as well. Thanks so much for
coming in.
So, Wendy, let me start with you. You were back at school today. What kinds of things were you seeing and hearing from students today?
Today was actually kind of a quiet day. We were really prepared to have many more students coming down, kind of trying to process what happened on last Friday. And, you know, we had a few students come down, but really, I think it was more the adults that really just needed to kind of process and vent and try and make sense out of what has happened.
That's an interesting place to start, and I wanted to get there, actually. Mm-hmm. This idea of how to talk to our kids, mm-hmm. I mean, I think you put your finger on something really, really important, and that is we sort of have to do a little bit of metabolizing ourselves before we can be helpful to our kids. Is that right?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I work at Whitman-Hanson Regional High School, you know, 1,200 students. We have wonderful staff and mental health supports. And in the back of your mind, you're working in a public school, you think, could it ever happen here? It never enters the realm of consciousness that it would happen at an elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the initial reaction of numbness, of disbelief, of I can't wrap my head around what just happened. You know, at the elementary schools in our district, they started the day with an early staff meeting to kind of process and let the teachers kind of know where they could go for some support during the day, what to say to the children, where to direct them if the kids were upset. And my colleagues were saying that it was really a forum for everyone just to, you know, express their disbelief. And, you know, a lot of the staff at schools are parents themselves.
Sure.
And it really hit close to home for a lot of them that have the younger kids in elementary school, that they just, you know, it's the shock and disbelief. So definitely trying to kind of wrap your own head around it first before bringing it up to the kids is probably the best idea.
And Deborah Rivlin, when it comes to talking to our kids about this, I've been sort of on a lot of forums and looking at a lot of stuff online about sort of how to handle this, whether talking to very young kids or older kids. I think the most useful piece of advice that I came across was first find out what they know, what they've learned.
Exactly. Especially with young children, I think we can't make assumptions what they're feeling, because we may be overwhelmed as the adults. Yeah. We don't want to project that on our children. We need to find out what do they need to know. It's very important to be honest and answer their questions, no matter how old a child is. But you do need to know developmentally you would speak differently to a young child than you would to a teenager like who Wendy's working with.
Mm-hmm.
But that you would find out what do they need to know. Tell the most basic truth to the young child if they need to know. and then what they add on when they need to know more. You don't want to change the story.
Yeah.
You don't want to lie to a child and then they find out. We know that children overhear. They, you know, hear from other kids, and they begin to weave together a story to them that makes sense. And if we don't, we need as adults to clear up their misconceptions and misinformation.
So let me tell you very briefly what happened to me on Friday. I have a 15-year-old daughter, and as I was driving home, still very shaken by this whole thing, I wanted to talk to her because I was concerned about what she had heard about this, whether she was upset about this. And like a lot of teenagers her age, she was very much still in her own bubble. She sort of had heard about it, but not really, and didn't seem, at least then, at all shaken by it. And it was me that wanted to say, did you hear about this? Do you know about this? I want you to know about this so that I can then assure you about it. I didn't go that route, but that was my impulse, you know?
No, absolutely. And I think it's about listening and taking the cues from our children of what do they need to know. Letting them be involved. Like for your teen, if she was upset, you know, getting involved, what could she do? You know, what is she, if she's passionate about, I want to change the gun laws, or write, you know, letters to the people at Newtown, doing something actively, that's something that's helpful.
And Wendy Price, in terms of protecting the very young kids, that is, from radio shows, maybe even a show like this, from TV, from news reports, advisable at this point?
Absolutely. Especially the younger kids that cognitively aren't able to really process, you know, kind of this mass media visual image of parents getting upset and, you know, students being walked out of the school, you know, shutting off the TV, parents, and limiting the amount of, you know, news intake that happens during your child's waking hours is going to be crucial. And a colleague, a school psychologist colleague of mine at one of our elementary schools, told her, you know, first and second grade children, kids are going to talk about this, you know, some kids more than others. And like you had said, some of the stuff may not be true. Come to me, ask me. I will be honest and tell you the facts as I know them. Because, you know, kids do, exactly as you said, try and, you know, make their own sense of what they've been hearing, bits and pieces. And it's important to be as direct as possible, keeping in mind the developmental level of the child that you're speaking to.
Let me ask you the most basic question that might come from a child. And I'll start with you, Deborah. Why would someone do this?
Well, I would say in this, if they knew what happened, I think it's important that they don't think just anybody who's, you know, mentally fine just does this. I think you have to say there are physical illnesses that affect our body, and there are mental illnesses that affect our thinking. And this person was very, 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 very sick mentally, and he couldn't make good decisions, and his brain wasn't working right. And it's hard to understand even for adults, but we know something was wrong with his brain, the way it was working.
And the one thing that I would add to that, Deborah, is also just to let you know, the children know that there are people that can help you.
Absolutely.
You know, that you know, this is an instance of you know, someone not knowing or not being able to seek out people to receive the sort of help that this kid needed. And that in the schools and, you know, your family and in the community, there are people that will help you if you know, you know of a friend who, you know, may be struggling with, you know, some sort of, you know, mental health issue. There are people available, like myself and like
Absolutely.
Deborah, that's our job, is to try and help people make good choices, and that you know what to do if you're feeling upset, angry, disconnected. There are people that you can talk to about that.
You're not alone. I think
sure.
that's so important.
Yes, yes.
Another very basic question that I could imagine hearing is, you know, mommy, daddy, is this going to happen in my school?
Well, and I think
Wendy Price first. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. I think I know that, you know, the majority of schools, probably, especially the elementary schools, you know, may have reviewed their safety plans, you know, over the last, you know, Friday and today, and they'll continue to do so. And, you know, I think it's important for parents to remind students that, you know, your school does have plans. That's why you have fire drills. That's why you have safety drills to practice. Although, you know, instances like this are very, very rare. You know, everyone's doing everything that they possibly can to try and keep, you know, your school safe the same way that we, you know, lock our doors at night and we try and keep the family safe, just to kind of reassure them without, you know, it is a fine line between that and making them more anxious.
Yeah, Deborah Rivlin.
I was going to say the same thing. We have to be careful that we're not projecting
exactly
that we're making them so afraid that they didn't think about it, and now they're thinking, "Wow, I'm not safe. Look what they're doing."
So we got to be careful not to introduce our own fears into their conversation.
Right. And I think the way that you started with, you have to listen to the kids. That's the number one thing: is listen and don't interrupt them. Let them explain in their own words what they think they know, what they've heard, kind of what they're feeling, and then, you know, jump off from that point as opposed to kind of projecting how you're trying to wrap your head around it.
And I was going to say problem solving with kids. If a child was scared, to say, what would help you feel safer?
Right.
I would do that with any age kid. I think what's taken away from us is power and control when this happens. So anything you can do to give back a sense of empowerment or control, that they can make some decisions, or, yeah, I would want to sleep with my light on now. Okay, you know, I want to know where the emergency exit is. Well, we can do that.
Listeners, we're talking with Wendy Price and Deborah Rivlin about how to talk about the tragic events that occurred in Newtown, Connecticut on Friday with our kids. Is this something that you've been talking about with your kids? If so, how have you been talking about it? What questions have they had for you? What questions do you have for Wendy Price, who's a psychologist at a public school on the South Shore, and Deborah Rivlin, Director of Education and Training at the Children's Room? That's a nonprofit dedicated to supporting grieving families. You can join the conversation at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Erin, who's calling from Brighton. Hi, Erin. You're on the air.
Hi there. I'm a preschool teacher in Newton, Massachusetts. But I grew up next to Newtown, Connecticut, and was there over the weekend. And right now my kids are too young to be spoken to it directly. But they do have older siblings, and a lot of the Newton schools are bringing it up with some of the older kids. So we are seeing kind of a little, you know, trickle effect, like a trickle-down effect, where the kids are sort of understanding that something's up. But we also have a lot of parents who are sort of going into a frenzied state and are coming to us quite frightened about what we should be doing to be protecting the kids more. And that sort of, in turn, the kids are very intuitive, and they're starting to pick up on this fear because their parents are now so frightened.
Very interesting. So, Erin, what's your advice? What are you telling the parents?
Well, right now, the kids are just so intuitive, and they need to know that it's a terrible thing that happened, but it's really not something that happens every day. And when a kid hears something like this, they just put it into their understanding of the world. And we don't want them thinking that they can't come to school safely. They really need to be reassured that they're safe and not worry about there not being enough security at their school.
Erin, thanks so much for the call. We appreciate it. Deborah Rivlin.
I would say, Erin, what might be helpful is if you opened had like a meeting with the parents and invited them to come together to talk about this, and then you could, you know, lead it and talk about how kids developmentally understand what you're seeing, what could be helpful. You know, sometimes coming together, you might not have that same kind of panic, or gives a forum for people to discuss that outside of, not with the children.
Erin, we really appreciate the call. You know, over the weekend, Deborah and Wendy, the New York Times blog Motherlode wrote a really thoughtful piece that got a lot of response, how not to talk with children about the Newtown shooting. And the author wrote, and Erin's call sort of brings this to mind, the author wrote, "Part of me wants to tell my children what happened and then drill them wildly on how to protect themselves. I want to promise that it could never happen here and at the same time reassure myself." So there does seem to be this sort of separation we need to make about how we're feeling and trying to understand how much our kids are processing. Is that
absolutely?
Yeah,
and I think it's important, you know, to be as honest as you can, as concrete as you can, and, you know, again, walking that fine line of not making these kind of unrealistic promises, you know, this all or nothing sort of attitude, but just reassuring the kids that, you know, we're doing everything we can to keep you safe.
Let me introduce John Palfrey into the conversation. He's been listening on the line. He's head of Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts. And John Palfrey, great to have you on Radio Boston. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you wrote a letter to your school community, a copy of which actually we've posted at radioboston.org. And I was very moved by it. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you about this and in the context of this conversation. Give us a sense of sort of what you're advising your community in the wake of what happened in Newtown.
Thank you so much, and you're nice to include me in the conversation. We've been focusing here at our school, as I think in every school, on our kids and families and trying to give them some tools to think about this issue and to figure out how to react in ways that are as positive as possible. And the advice that I've gotten from people who focus on teenagers and our school is grades 9 to 12, is really to give them something positive to do with their energy. So the approach that we've been taking is, of course, consistent with what your previous guests have been talking about, but also then to say to kids that one of the ways to harness their feelings is to think about three things they can do. I wrote about empathy, which was to echo what the president said last night, that we can all stand with the families in Newtown. And we've seen our students tweeting with the pound prayers for Newtown a hashtag and things like that in a public conversation. The second is to practice compassion, to think about other people in our communities where we can be kind to them and to express, you know, sort of positive emotions that may come out of a tragedy. And the third is really engagement. And I know that our kids, at least, are ones who are very often find they can express themselves in a way that takes up a public issue, and that gives them a way to process some of their emotions. So I urge them to engage in various ways in the discussion about gun control versus the Second Amendment and the Second Amendment and things like the paucity of mental health care in our country. And I think giving kids a way to express themselves positively at this moment would help get over some of that helplessness that a lot of them are feeling.
Yeah,
I agree.
You know, go ahead, Deborah Rivlin.
No, I totally agree with everything you just said.
You know, John, one of the things that I liked so much about your letter is it was so thoughtful, such a thoughtful way to engage and be sensitive to the kids at Andover. But, you know, honestly, as a parent reading your letter, I found it very helpful because one of the, I think you put your finger on a word, and that is helplessness. I mean, one of the things that I've been very troubled by is this enormous sense of grief on behalf of what has happened in Newtown, but feeling like that's not helping anything. You know, I want my grief to matter more. I want to figure out a way to join my heart with what has gone on in Newtown, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
No, it's beautifully put. I think it is sort of the definition of what a community can be, is when we can join our grieving hearts in a way that actually adds up to something more than ourselves.
Mm. Yeah,
it's also an opportunity to learn coping skills around loss, to know what you do, what is taken something actively, like your guest is saying, that you can make a difference. Even for young children in the preschool, like Aaron's kids, could make drawings and send them to Newtown to the school. That helps them and it helps the kids doing it.
Exactly. And we had students that came, you know, to our offices today and said, you know, we made this poster, this memorial poster that we'd like to put up in the hall with the names of the students and their ages. And, you know, that's their way of kind of harnessing their grief and trying to say, you know, it wasn't all for nothing. You know, we're trying to recognize the fact that, you know, a tragedy happened and these innocent lives were lost, and we're doing something to kind of honor their memory. And the same as you were saying at your daughter's school, you know, wearing the school colors, you know, this week, you know, it's going to be green and white and blue and yellow to kind of honor Newtown's school colors. So, you know, trying to harness that grief and trying to turn it into something that is, you know, an action that people can see and they feel that they're a part of the healing.
Let's take a couple more calls. We've got a bunch of people who want to get in on this conversation. Let's go to Nancy, who is calling from Wareham. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a kindergarten teacher, and my advice to the parents in my class was to spare your young children the news, if at all possible. This, to me, is an adult worry, and young children, 4 and 5, don't have the ability to comprehend time and distance. They don't know where Newtown, Connecticut is. So someone just mentioned joining hearts in a community of grief, but that should not involve our little children, in my opinion.
Nancy, I really appreciate the perspective. Wendy Price, do you want to respond to Nancy's concern there?
Yeah, I would just say that, you know, I don't know if you've been listening, Nancy. Earlier I had said that, you know, for the parents of little kids, turning off the TV and trying to limit the amount of, you know, discussion and media intake around this, because they're not developmentally able to kind of process what's happening, and it can have, you know, we think we're doing a nice job, but it could be in fact scaring kids that may not have those fears to begin with.
But you do have to watch their play and watch what they're saying, because little children do hear things and do put things together. So you can't make the assumptions that they're not getting it from the older children.
Exactly.
And so you want to watch their play, watch what they're saying, because usually it will come out that way.
Right.
Nancy, really grateful for your call. Let's go to Kristen, who's calling from Tewksbury. Hi, Kristen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I'm a teacher of high school students, and in talking with my teenagers today, they wanted to know about, you know, maybe some of the mental illness that was, you know, partially at least responsible for this. Mm-hmm. And in, you know, some of the diagnoses that have been mentioned are also diagnoses that some of my students have.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to know how to talk to them in a way, you know, you're safe because this was a monster, but not everyone with these possible diagnoses is a monster.
Boy, Kristen, it's a deep and important question. Deborah, do you want to take a crack at that?
No, I mean, absolutely. I think that's the problem with people just saying, oh, he had Asperger's,
right,
and this is why, when in fact, if you know anything about Asperger's, that is not typical. It wasn't he absolutely had a mental illness, whatever else that he had. And I think we do need to have the conversations open about that. Again, anything we can do to clear up misinformation and misconceptions, I think is so important. And that's why opening this up, we don't have the opportunity that often to talk about these difficult things. And I think it's important that we do. That is an opportunity.
I agree. Absolutely, Deborah.
John Palfrey, I know you're out there. I don't want to lose you completely in this conversation, but anything that you hear from our callers, please chime in. And I'm just curious, though. I know your school has already broken for the holiday. Is that right?
That's true. Actually, our students are not here. They've gone home, which is a curious thing, where we're trying to have a conversation in cyberspace when they're not actually physically with us.
Is something planned to mark this upon their return, or any thinking in that direction?
Absolutely. I mean, we will mark it with the staff and other communities here. And we have a big adult community, about 600 people who work at the school. So we're focused on that community as well, doing something at the flagpole and a conversation around it. But when the kids come back, we'll think about where the conversation stands at that point.
Sure.
But we certainly will engage kids in the process that your other guests have been describing.
And let me ask you, both Deborah and Wendy, what if a child doesn't appear worried at all? Kids are famously self-absorbed after all. You know, what warning signs might a parent or a teacher want to look for sort of down the road as a concern brews slowly and then eventually comes to the surface? Let me start with you, Deborah.
It's what I wanted to say is that this is a process. It's not going to be over in a few days, which I think is society kind of wants this. Well, this will be over. It's in the news now and it's over. Actually, the way kids grieve is very sporadically. So it's not unusual that you might not see anything right now and then things might come up later. And it's a process. So certainly when the kids, you know, your kids come back to school, it doesn't mean that it's over. And I think we need to really think about that. I think we need to watch the kids and see their behavior, what's going on. Like for the little kids, like I said, their play, the older kids, what they're saying, you know, what they're talking about, if there's new fears or any of that. And those are, you know, warning signs of huge kind of changes.
Sure.
Right. And I would also kind of, to piggyback on that, you know, teachers are with students, you know, a good chunk of the day, and parents obviously are with their children even longer. And so you know your kid.
Yeah.
And so any kind of change in behavior, appetite, sleep patterns, an increase in anxiety, or, you know, the kid is complaining more about stomach aches or headaches, or Monday morning, I don't want to go to school. You know, these are all things that in isolation may not mean much, but when you start to sense that they're forming a pattern, that's when, you know, you really kind of need to seek some help. And the other kids that we need to talk about are the kids that have already been through past traumatic experience and personal loss.
Mm.
You know, I mean, these are the kids, this could really trigger some of these kids. So just, you know, being aware that everybody kind of handles things differently, and they come from different coping skills and different resources in terms of how they're able to develop their resilience.
Deborah, in the sort of 30 seconds or so that we have left, you told our producer, Amory Sievertson, that you prefer the approach, what can our society do, as opposed to how are you feeling about this? I'd love you to explain that approach
a little bit. Sometimes I think kids, they don't want us to directly, especially adolescents, and Wendy could talk more about that even, but of saying, how are you feeling about this? I think sometimes it's saying, talking about it more in general, like what can we do in our society?
Right.
So what can we do more? It's almost more third person in having that conversation of problem solving together,
right,
versus singling out somebody and saying, most kids don't like it that way.
Right. And having a healthy debate, like we were saying, about, you know, the need for support for mental health, yes, you know, kind of services versus gun control, and having that kind of, you know, adult conversation with some of the kids that are at that level.
Exactly. Let this be an opportunity.
An opportunity indeed. That's what we hope can come out of this dreadful story. Thank you all so much for joining us today. Wendy Price, psychologist at a public high school in the South Shore. She's the former president of the Massachusetts School Psychologist Association. Wendy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank
we appreciate
you very much
it.
For having me.
And Deborah Rivlin, Director of Education and Training at the Children's Room. That's a nonprofit dedicated to supporting grieving families. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And John Palfrey, head of Phillips Academy in Andover, Mass. John Palfrey, thank you very much, and happy holidays.
Thank you. Same to you.
Stay with us. Coming up, how do we look for warning signs among troubled young people who might resort to violence? Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.